It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll try and solve the mystery of uniquely Midwestern ice cream in our Curious Wisconsin segment.
But first, federal officials announced today that they filed insider trading charges against SAC Capital Advisors.
That firm is led by billionaire Stephen Cohen, who had civil charges filed against him last week. What does all this mean? Joining us to talk about these developments is Peter Henning, professor of law at Wayne State University. He writes the White Collar Watch blog for the New York Times Deal Book. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, give us the brief 101. What kind of charges is this company facing?
Well, the grand jury returned charges of wire fraud and securities fraud for insider trading that the government is saying goes all the way back to 1999. And so in the indictment, it identifies six different former analysts or portfolio managers at the firm who have pleaded guilty to insider trading already, one of whom did just a couple days ago. And then it also has one other trader who is under indictment, and his trial is supposed to start in November. So identifies seven different people at the firm for trading on inside information. And then under federal law, a company or organization like SAC is responsible for the acts of its employees. So it's charged separately for what they did.
So the notion is what? That the company either made them do this or instructed them to do this or turned a blind eye as they were doing this?
Well, the way federal law works and corporate criminal liability works, if the employee is acting within the scope of his or her employment, in other words, it's part of your duties, and there is at least the potential for some benefit to the company, then the company can be held criminally responsible for what the employee does. It's the Latin legal phrase that's given to it is respondeat superior. You get this in tort law. If you're a driver of a truck for Walmart and you hit someone while making a delivery, Walmart can be held liable for the injuries to the victim. Well, the same thing applies in criminal law. So what the government is saying is because your employees traded on inside information and you got the benefit of it, and certainly SAC did, then SAC can be charged with a crime. It's not done very often, but it is a basis for criminal liability for a corporation.
It's not done very often. You say, what is there a high bar, or are these kind of cases hard to prove? Why doesn't this get charged more often?
No, in fact, it's a very low bar, and that's what corporations complain about, that it is so easy to prove it. The government tends not to go after companies unless it sees some kind of systematic problem. So one of the most famous cases in the last decade or so was when the government charged Arthur Andersen related to its obstruction of justice related to Enron. It went after the entire accounting firm for what happened in one particular office. Prosecutors are leery of doing it against some companies, banks, financial organizations like that, because it can end up destroying the organization. So it's not so much that there's much of a legal bar, it's more that prosecutors are concerned with what are called the collateral consequences, the fallout. People are going to lose their jobs if the company's put out of business.
And let's talk about the fallout here. We have Stephen Cohen, the owner of this company, SAC Capital. Is this company a big deal in the hedge fund trade?
Well, it's considered a big deal to the extent that it is one of the most successful hedge funds, but at its peak, its assets were about $15 billion. Half of that, or a little bit more than half of that, is Cohen's own money. He's made an awful lot of money through this firm. And then the rest is investment for outside investors, many of whom have withdrawn their funds. So impact on investors from the indictment and even, say, a conviction is not going to be significant because there's not that much money left in the firm. It employs about 1,000 people, and some of them will no doubt lose their jobs, which is, of course, then an impact on those people. But, you know, you're not talking about the demise of a large corporation, a big employer. And, in fact, many of the employees, you know, the professionals, if they lose their jobs, You know, this is Wall Street. If they can make money, they're going to land on their feet.
So this is not nothing, but it isn't a domino that's going to start taking a whole bunch of other companies with it?
No, not at all. In fact, this has been anticipated, if not for a couple months, at least for the last couple of weeks. And so investors have been pulling their money pretty substantially out of SAC. And so the impact on the financial system is not much more than a blip. On individual lives, if you're losing your job, that's a big thing. But from the broader perspective, it's not going to have much of an effect.
Let's talk insider trading a little bit. I mean, I get the sense that all of these people are, angling for information that the other guy doesn't have to get ahead and make a little better return. Where does it cross the line from a legal point of view, from the federal point of view, into insider trading that we got to prosecute?
Well, that's a very good question. There are a lot of gray areas here. There's not a statute that prohibits insider trading. It really is a crime that has been created by the courts, and it's a type of securities fraud. And it's not just that you have confidential information, but that you received it and are using it in breach of an obligation to keep it secret. So if you're a corporate employee, you're not allowed to benefit personally from the information. Now, information is the currency of Wall Street. Firms want to get an edge on one another. In fact, in the indictment of SAC, it talks about how some traders had what they called a black edge. In other words, that they had that informational edge, but they appear to have gotten it improperly. Information doesn't come with a label saying, I'm inside information, don't trade on me. You can get information from anywhere. You could go down to a local store and say, gosh, there are an awful lot of customers here. I should buy this stock. Mm-hmm. Is that inside information? No, probably not. If you talk to a manager at the store who says, we're doing great business and our other five outlets are doing real well, boy, you're awfully close to inside information there. So this is a fuzzy area of the law.
But if you talk to that manager and they say, don't tell anyone, but we're closing our China operations next week, start trading?
That's going to be insider trading. A lot of these cases, the government tends not to bring cases that are right out at the edge. But if you look at the cases involving SAC, this is where they got information from people at companies like Dell, drug makers, Elon and Wyeth, about impending information, earnings, how a clinical trial was going to go, and then trading on it. Kind of information that's going to have a real impact on how a company does.
Now, if I'm one of these federal prosecutors or I'm an investigator, am I feeling some kind of political pressure to not go after these big guys, to not potentially disrupt the economy? What kind of political heat are these people under?
For insider trading, it gets a lot of headlines. But as far as market impact goes, it really is quite minor because it tends to be what I would call episodic, that it's just, it's an upcoming earnings announcement. It's an upcoming takeover. But the impact on the market is often really very small. If you look at how many shares are traded every day, we're talking billions of shares being traded. And the insider trading cases often involve thousands or hundreds of thousands of shares. So it's really a kind of a small slice of the market, even though it gets the big headlines. If you want to talk impact, look at in the financial crisis, the mortgage market. That affected hundreds of thousands of people, millions across the country, far more than any one insider trading case. But insider trading is, if you will, sexy. It's also easy to understand, and it kind of fuels or at least feeds into the anti-Wall Street, anti-elite. You don't see poor people trading on inside information. You tend to see the wealthy doing it, and that makes it easier to say, this is wrong. We're actually trying to curb Wall Street here.
Looking ahead, and we've kind of been here before, do you think the message Wall Street companies are going to take is, we need to back away, go into the lighter gray zone, not into the darker gray zone? Or is it keep doing what we're doing, but let's be more careful about getting caught?
I would love to be able to say that this will have a deterrent effect, and that these are the type of people who should be deterred, that they are reading the news and seeing that there's a risk of losing millions of dollars, and indeed even some of the insider trading sentences lately have been upwards of 10 years in prison. That said, it sure seems to happen a lot, and I wonder whether the person on Wall Street is saying the ones who get caught are the dumb ones, or there's so much pressure to succeed that, you know, I'll edge over the line just a little bit. And of course, as you keep edging over that line, you suddenly discover you're a long way over. So I wonder whether it will have that much of an impact. Certainly in the short term, it will. People are going to be more careful. You'll get greater compliance. But, you know, 5 years from now, is anybody going to remember SAC? I wonder.
Peter, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Peter Henning, professor of law at Wayne State University.
Our Curious Wisconsin segment is up next, and today we're going to try and solve the mystery of an ice cream we see a lot around Wisconsin, a little bit around the bordering states, not so much elsewhere. Blue Moon Ice Cream. We'll find out about the story behind Blue Moon. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's time for Curious Wisconsin, where we try and find the answers to your burning questions about the state.
And the heat wave is finally over, and during that time, odds are a lot of ice cream got eaten, maybe some Blue Moon.
My kids ate a lot of Blue Moon, and it's a mysterious flavor. It's a weird thing with a weird history, Blue Moon. And now joining us to shed some light on the mystery is Casey Steinbrink. He's a writer, a producer at Who Knew, an arts and culture website covering the Fox Cities. He wrote a piece called Melting, The Mystery of Blue Moon. He joins us from our studio in Green Bay. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
You tried to research the origins of Blue Moon. You ran into some obstacles. Tell us about them.
Well, first of all, let's just say this wasn't a really intense investigative report. It's more of a tongue-in-cheek story on Blue Moon. And there are some people out there, some journalists who've done some pretty decent investigative reporting, including a woman who wrote for the Chicago Tribune. And that's where I found most of the information on the origins of Blue Moon ice cream. But, you know, a lot of people don't realize that it's a flavor that you can only really find in the upper Midwest and mostly in Wisconsin and Michigan. You can find it a little bit in, I think, Indiana and upper Illinois and, you know, the Twin Cities area. But most of it comes from Wisconsin, and it actually was, in fact, most likely created here.
Now, it's a unique flavor. That's part of the reason maybe you don't see it everywhere. Now, our whole staff had a taste testing. Our most excellent producer, Chris Molina, went and grabbed us a pint. We all had some before the show. It was hard to put your finger on it. So how would you describe what it tastes like if
you. I was going to ask you guys what you thought it was because I've had it ever since I was a kid, but I've really never been able to nail it down. You know, there's a huge list of potential flavors that people think it might be, you know, from even things like pistachio and coconut and pineapple and marshmallow and bubblegum and cotton candy and a bunch of different berries and even amaretto and almond. One of the more interesting ones is Fruit Loops and milk.
That's what I think it tastes like.
Yeah. And the reason that I think that there's some merit behind that theory to Blue Moon ice cream is the guy who most people believe created it was named Bill Dockside, and he was a flavor chemist at Patran Products in Milwaukee. And it's believed that he created Blue Moon back in the 40s and 50s. The company that owns the recipe for Blue Moon now is Weber Flavors, based in Chicago, and they bought Patran Products in the 80s. But Bill Seiden was a flavor chemist, right? So it would stand to reason that maybe he took all these different flavors and mixed them together, since, you know, you've got a bunch of different artificial and quote-unquote natural flavors in Fruit Loops, and then mixed a whole bunch of them together and came up with Blue Moon.
Yeah.
So that's one, you know, one potential theory that I think has some meat behind it.
When we were talking in the office about the flavor and tasting it, yeah, Fruit Loops was one that came up, almond came up. We need like the equivalent of a wine expert. It's got a slightly fruit loopy taste with just a hint of almond and a bouquet of,
I don't know what.
Cleanse
your palate before you try
beaver
pelt.
Beaver pelt thing, was that, we've heard rumors that beaver pelt somehow played into somebody's Blue Moon recipe?
Well, it's
I don't buy it.
This is my personal potential theory for Blue Moon ice cream. Now, in one of the articles I read, a bigwig with Weber Flavors said, kind of gave a hint that, well, it's something that people would be surprised how often it's used. And he said it's an additive that's used in yogurt to get rid of a bitter flavor. So I started researching that, and I ran across a food additive called castoreum. And castoreum is something that comes from a beaver. And I don't want to gross everyone out too much. I know this is public radio, but it's something that beavers use to mark their territory. So, and it's a food additive that's found in vanilla and berry flavoring, which is what a lot of people think is in Blue Moon. So that's a possibility. It's just another theory, and that could be true. It couldn't be true. Who knows? But I guess there's about 300 pounds of castoreum created a
year,
which isn't really a lot.
Yeah.
It's not really that much. So
but it all goes into the Blue Moon ice cream.
Possibly. I guess the question is how much beaver spray do you need to flavor ice cream?
It's terrible. I'm never going to be able to eat it again.
Yeah, and one of the things I brought up was, well, if they want to keep the flavor a secret, then maybe this is the reason why, because it comes from, you know, a beaver's behind.
And I don't want to dwell on the beaver bottom theory, but okay, so castoreum, does that mean that it's being harvested from actual beavers?
I think it does. It comes from a gland.
From real live beavers?
I believe so, yes.
Wow.
Got to synthesize something.
Yeah.
What I associate Blue Moon with is childhood. I grew up in Michigan, and now I'm in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I ate Blue Moon all the time as a kid. It was my favorite flavor. I feel like I've outgrown, and it's not my thing anymore. And my kids love Blue Moon ice cream.
Yeah, mine too.
Veronica?
Same here.
And did you grow out of it too?
I never liked it.
You never liked
honestly.
It. And Casey, how about you? Do you still eat the stuff? Or
I love it. Yeah, it's one of those flavors like you either love it or you just think it's disgusting. I can still remember the first time I had it when I was a kid. I think it was a couple of my aunts took me out for ice cream, and I was sitting on top of the big glass case where all the big gallon jugs of or the big jugs of ice cream are, and I saw that blue stuff, and I was like, "What's that?" And I remember so distinctly, like at the ice cream, you know, parlor worker didn't know really how to tell me what it was. She's like, some people say it's pineapple, some people say it's coconut. Here, why don't you just try a little bit? And I tried it, and that was it. I loved Blue Moon ice cream because I think it's pretty good.
So the blue is just dye, right?
I believe so.
That color doesn't occur in nature.
Yeah, there's not much natural about that one.
Not even in the beaver.
All right, I got a off-the-wall question for you. One of our producers who just moved here from the East Coast, not familiar with Blue Moon ice cream, we were sampling it. He didn't want to eat it because he's got to do gluten-free. Do you know, since it's a secret, what ingredients are in there? They could be sprinkling wheat into the mix or something, I guess. Any idea, gluten-free or not?
I would think you would. Most packaging is probably going to tell you nowadays. It's such a big deal that when I look in ingredients lists, you know, wheat and soy and things like that are usually highlighted as far as food allergies. So I would think they would let you know if there was wheat in it. The thing that makes it the mystery is that when you look at the ingredients lists on Blue Moon, that last thing is just natural flavorings, which is what castoreum, not to go back to that, is listed as. Now, again, I don't want Weber Flavors suing me or anything like that. That's just a theory.
We have no proof.
We have no proof.
We have no proof.
But if they want to tell us what's in it,
we can speculate.
So now, if you wanted to recreate Blue Moon ice cream at home, any ideas how you might try, since we don't really know what's in it?
Well, there are a lot of people out there who are trying. If you search Blue Moon recipes online, you'll get up a lot of different ideas. I found one that, based on comments from people, seems like it could be pretty accurate. And it's an anonymous poster on food.com who had a recipe for homemade Blue Moon, and it has raspberry, lemon oil, and vanilla pudding. And a lot of people who commented said that they think it might be the vanilla pudding that is the secret to kind of keeping that creaminess. Because a lot of people say it has a berry flavor, but it's also a little bit citrusy. So, but this person on food.com, if you check out our article on hunu.com, you can find the link to it there. But it has some really good reviews from people from Wisconsin, including people who said their kids tried it and said it was spot on.
Ah.
So I don't have an ice cream maker, so I haven't tried it myself yet. But I think if anyone wants to go out there, try it, leave us a comment and tell us how accurate it is. I'd be curious to know.
Casey, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
That's Casey Steinbrink, writer and producer at Who Knew. We've got a link to his article, Melting the Mystery of Blue Moon, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at body mass index, or BMI, as a measure of overall health and whether or not it's fair. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Questions surrounding the body mass index, or the BMI, have been making news lately. Earlier this month, Britain's National Institute of Health released a study suggesting that BMI indicators may be ethnically biased.
Also this month, the Boy Scouts of America announced that in order to take part in this year's Jamboree, Scouts must have a BMI of 31.9 or less.
And Massachusetts is considering doing away with the requirement that schools report student BMIs to parents because it increased bullying and weight-related anxiety.
We'd like to hear what you think about the accuracy, the relevance of the body mass index, whether you think it should be used to determine your health and your ability. Has the BMI ever been used to disqualify you for something? Is your doctor nagging you about your BMI, or are you a doctor who nags people about it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Joining us now is Dr. McKinley Petty of Milwaukee with the American Society of Bariatric Physicians. Welcome, Dr. Petty.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Pretty good.
Well, so we use the BMI, the body mass index, right now as a tool to tell whether or not someone is obese. But what's the thinking today about whether the BMI is a fair and accurate way to judge?
Well, really, the BMI is a relationship between your weight and your height. And so there are a lot of factors that would affect that, including musculature, your age, et cetera. So it's a good starting tool, but it's not something that you can use with absolute certainty if what you're actually trying to do is evaluate obesity.
And, of course, you have stories have been out there about people who work out a lot, who've got a lot of muscle mass, will turn up on the BMI as obese, and, of course, they're not too crazy about that. What about situations like that?
Well, what the situation is that you take your weight and you divide it by your height, and there's a formula to do that, and they have charts for that. And what that basically does is that a person who is is a fit person that lift weights, etc., it would give a false impression that the BMI is higher than it actually is. And so if you look at the charts, someone with a calculation, and again, this is on charts that you can readily access, is above 30. That gives an indication possibly of increased chance for various diseases like hypertension, cholesterol problems, diabetes, et cetera. So a person that's fit and muscular, the BMI could be inaccurate. And then on the other hand, a person that looks normal to the eye could be at risk because it's a measurement of how much fat the person has on their torso, on their body, not torso.
How old is this calculation of the body mass index? How long has it been around?
Well, it's really gotten in use, I believe, in the 70s. But the calculation has been around since the early part of the last century. But as far as practical use, I believe it was the early 70s that it started being used for some type of a diagnostic tool.
Now, some of the news we're hearing lately is that the BMI might be ethnically biased, that there are certain ethnic groups who don't fit the standard model for the BMI as we know it. It's sort of one size fits all now, pardon the pun, but that might not actually be accurate. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, the situation, again, is that if a person is, there's a formula, and what that is you would take, let's say, as an example, you take someone's weight in kilograms, and then you would divide that by their height in meters squared, and you would come up with a number. So if you have ethnic groups that are more fine frame, slim frame, however you would like to phrase that, their BMI would be a certain number that wouldn't necessarily reflect the adiposity, the fat storage that that person would have. Also, thickness of the bones, et cetera, height in general. All of those things are going to be affected by this BMI, which really is just a real rough screening tool. As far as diagnostic, it really shouldn't be used for that if what you're trying to do is predict further comorbidities down the road.
Now, can you give us a sense of which ethnic groups might need to have their BMIs tweaked?
Well, to tell you the truth, all. Because
everybody.
Everyone, because it gives you some idea of what's going on, but it doesn't really tell you if what you're trying to do is screen people for preventative measures down the road. You can have a person, whatever ethnic group, and they can look like they're the picture of health. But then if you were to check them out metabolically, which is what you really want to do, their metabolism would not look like you would want it to prevent diseases down the road. So it would apply across the board, really.
Now, when I started reading some journalism on this, a little bit about it, I'm Latina. I thought, hey, this could be good news. Maybe I get to have an extra 10 pounds. Turns out, guess what? It's the other direction. And apparently this ethnic group should weigh, you know, less on the BMI. So it's not necessarily talking about being, you know, more generous in terms of weight. It's some of these ethnic groups,
well,
they're saying you have
to
slim down.
That when we're talking about BMI, if we're just talking about fat, you can't take that to the bank as a diagnostic tool to prevent diseases down the road. See, that's the point that I'm trying to make. It's good for possibly, you know, mass population where you just want to kind of get a general idea of what that population is doing. It might be good for that sort of thing to get some idea where on the BMI scale that population is. But in terms of individual diagnostic tools for preventing cardiac disease, diabetes type 2, et cetera, that's not something that you can really count on an individual level.
Now, you're talking about it in a very balanced way. You're looking at it in terms of predicting future health problems like diabetes, cholesterol, heart disease. On the other hand, not everybody sees it like you, and there are a lot of people out there, including the Boy Scouts, for instance, who are screening some scouts out of their jamboree if their BMIs are above a certain level, who use it as an across-the-board measure. So I guess I would ask you, are we overusing the BMI and putting too much reliance on it when it's clearly a lot more complex than that?
Well, it's much more complex than that, and as I say, for example, if you're taking the Boy Scouts and you take a whole population of them, whether it's statewide or that individual group, et cetera, it just gives you an idea of what that particular population might look
like. Right, but the question is, are we overusing it?
I would say that if someone specializes in this area, as I do, it's not something that I really use to predict what's going to happen.
You'd like to get more nuanced with it.
Well, you need, when we're talking about an abnormal BMI, let's use some numbers. Someone that has this calculation that's 30 or above, that by definition means that there's a possibility of future diseases, as I described before, occurring. Now, when you look at them from a metabolic point of view, meaning you get some hormones and lipid panel, which is cholesterol, et cetera, that looks very different. It can look very different than what that BMI says. So if what I'm doing is screening someone that's, say, 35 years old, there's going to be some external things that I might see, but there may not be some external things that I might see, which means that that person's BMI may be normal. But those are the people that you're really concerned about, because even though they look fit, their BMI is within a normal range, they have a risk for these diseases as well, and you worry about them because it doesn't show you from the outside. So the BMI doesn't really tell you anything about those people.
So should we throw it out if it's not that accurate? Should we just say, you know what, this tool is not sophisticated enough, and when we're screening this broadly, we're maybe hurting people. Maybe it's not doing us much good.
I would say if the objective is to identify people that you want to prevent future disease, as hypertension, as diabetes, as heart disease, etc., it's not going to be that useful. It can be, but that's not what I would rely on. I'd have to have additional tests.
Gotcha.
For example, you have someone that they look healthy. They look normal according to what society decides. And you're talking to them, and they have various things going on, and their family history is full of diabetes and heart disease and et cetera, et cetera. You'd want to go further than the BMI. You would not rely on that to decide what was going to be the outcome.
We are talking to Dr. McKinley Petty of the American Society of Bariatric Physicians, asking about the BMI, the body mass index, very commonly used to determine whether someone is at risk for certain health problems and whether in general they're obese, which puts them at risk for problems. And wondering now whether it is biased, whether we're overusing it, whether it's time for a new measure of health and fitness besides the BMI. And we're wondering about your experiences with that as well.
You can join the show at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Are you in a line of work where this is relevant? Epidemiology? Are you a doctor? Do you work with kids and fitness? Do you think the BMI gives you a quick ballpark and lets you know when we need to do a little more work? Or do you think it's a waste of time? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll take your calls coming up. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking now about the Body Mass Index, better known as the BMI, with Dr. McKinley Petty of the American Society of Bariatric Physicians. And we're taking your calls. We're wondering whether you think the BMI is a useful screening tool or whether it's really not nuanced enough to be of as much benefit as it could be, whether it gives false impressions of obesity, whether it's perhaps harmful for kids if they get tagged with it too early. What do you think about the BMI?
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
And let's take a call now. Mary joins us from St. Germain. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
Our company uses the BMI as part of a screening tool for our wellness program, and we have found that some of the more fit people actually are scoring as either overweight or even worse with the BMI, and we're just finding it to be not at all a very useful screening tool in the sense of corporate wellness.
All right. Thanks for that perspective, Mary. What do you think, Dr. Petty?
Well, let me clarify one thing. When we talk about obesity, and let's say that we actually have a case of obesity here that needs attention, that's a metabolic abnormality. So when you evaluate people from a laboratory standpoint, they're going to be checkpoints that are not that are off, that are not normal, et cetera, et cetera, that follows obesity. So when we're talking about the BMI index, it's the problem is a metabolic problem, and the BMI doesn't reflect that. So it may be a tool for, let's say, if you were to track BMI in an individual, say over several years and it's going up, I mean, that indicates something, or if it's going down, that may indicate something. So it may be useful from that point of view. But if we're actually trying to do something about obesity, it's a metabolic problem, and that BMI doesn't really tell you anything in that regard.
Gotcha. All right, a couple of Facebook comments here. Jake on Facebook says, so I'm a rock climber and a little on the short side. I have no fat on my body, but due to my hobbies and work, I'm extremely strong. And my new doctor is surprised about how much I weigh, guessing, you know, he'd get a questionable reading on the BMI. And another comment, Tim on Facebook says, most serious academics in the field have pretty much discredited BMI, haven't they? I think the, quote, real world is just lagging behind a bit. Has the BMI been discredited, or at least are people tossing in a bit of salt with it?
Well, let me just say this. I see a lot of obese people, and so I have the wheels on the ground. BMI is not something that I really concern myself with. So when you get into the controversy about that, it's really not something I even use. But if what you're doing is talking about trying to be just some semblance of a screen process, it's easy to do, it doesn't cost any money, et cetera, et cetera. But as far as treating obesity, obesity is a metabolic problem of which the BMI says nothing about.
Do you think that most doctors use it the way that you do?
Well, if you're talking about the obesity field, the treatment of obesity, as I say, it's a metabolic disease. It takes a lot of time to work with people to find out what's going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Most family docs or primary care physicians, they don't really have the time to invest in that, and so therefore they would refer to someone like me, and then I would do what would be necessary to do. But they may use the BMI as a tool to refer, but most of the time, if there's a problem with the BMI that comes to their attention, you can really see that on the outside of the patient to begin with, not just the obesity, but there's other tags, too, that you can tell that there's something going on.
All right. Let's take another call. Dawn in Madison is with us. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. I was just wondering, you know, throughout the years, humans obviously have evolved, you know, the picture of a healthy human today is much different than it was in 1970, as it was in 1900, et cetera, et cetera. Makes me wonder, you know, has the way you calculate the BMI, has that evolved along the standard of the adult?
Okay, we caught most of what you said there, Dawn. And I think, Dr. Petty, you said that the BMI was first hatched in the 70s. So, yeah, we're looking at some 40 years onward. Has it changed?
That question was to me?
Yeah.
Repeat that. I didn't hear quite what she said.
Well, she wanted to know if the BMI had evolved, just as people have evolved.
You mean the interpretation of it? I'm assuming that's what you mean. The BMI, I guess the emphasis that we're talking about on this program in regard to BMI, as far as evaluating obesity and what to do about it, it's only the crudest screening tool that you can use. And it may be helpful, say, to evaluate the whole United States to kind of see what's the trend in the United States. But as far as an individual person and you wanting to treat them, it's not useful.
But I guess what I'm asking is, so the BMI you said was created in the 70s, right?
Well, before that. But
before that.
Popular use, I believe it was in the early 70s, yes.
So are we still reading it the way they would have in 1970?
Let's see. BMI is something that, if we're talking about commercial use, for example, whatever product you want to talk about, BMI is something that's kind of used so people will have an easy reference to know what's being discussed. If what we're doing is actually treating obesity, then we would have to get into some specific metabolic things that may not be available that the general public would know anything about. So BMI is a good way to get lay people to understand what the product is supposed to be trying to do, why the product, you know, is supposed to be doing what it's doing. But as far as a diagnostic tool and evolution, it's been tweaked so many times. Uh-huh. According to, let's say, take a BMI from the top half of the torso and then average that out with the bottom of the torso. If a person is taller, let's use, you know, a different formula You know, so it's being tweaked all the time to try to make up for its deficiencies. And in general, if what you're trying to do is treat obesity, it's a metabolic problem of which the BMI really doesn't come into play that much. Maybe you could use that. Maybe you could use it as the person is improving, and you see this general BMI number say go down, or maybe even go up. I mean, it might be useful in that way to just kind of see where the person is. But as far as treatment and trying to use that as a solid scientific thing, it's not that.
All right. Let's go to another caller now. Rich joins us from Chicago. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I was just wondering about this body mass index. I'm a truck driver, and I went in for my federal medical card, and they only gave me a card for 3 months because they're saying my BMI is, I'm 27 pounds over. I've always been a little bigger, and I see guys, you know, getting out of the trucks that are 400 or 500 pounds, and you know, it's, I just think that it's kind of a discriminatory thing because I'm in perfect health. I don't have any issues.
Right, and there are other people who say much the same as you. Well, thank you so much.
Can I ask him a question?
Yeah.
Can I ask him a question? Let me ask you this: is your girth, let's say your pot, does that hang over your belt? Not really. Is your flat there, or what's going on?
It doesn't. It's I've always been a little bigger in the shoulders and the upper body and stuff, and my neck is big, and they told me that I was over, and they said that to be in a normal weight range, I'd have to lose like 27 pounds, so it's not like I'm massively overweight or nothing, but, you know, they're telling me if I don't bring that 27 pounds down in 3 months, I won't be eligible for a federal medical card to drive.
Yeah, that's pretty serious. I don't know, Dr. Petty, we've got a lot of calls here, but real quickly, anything you could tell Rich that would be helpful?
Well, the BMI itself, let's just say that there is a problem. Let's assume that if they haven't taken any blood work, for example, to see what's actually going on metabolically, then they would go by the BMI. And if what you're saying is true, you don't have a pot hanging over your belly, because that's basically what it is, you know, belly fat that creates a whole other metabolic problem that can be dealt with. That can be dealt with. But if you don't have that and your BMI is higher than what they're saying, then that must mean that you're one of these muscular type people who the BMI exaggerates what your actual body fat is. So it's not effective in that case.
All right. Well, Rich, thank you so much for calling up, and good luck. And Dr. Petty, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Am I done now?
Yep, we are all set. Thank you for your time. We've been talking with Dr. McKinley Petty of the American Society of Bariatric Physicians. Just going to end with one more email from Melissa here, who says, I'm a registered dietitian. BMI is a useful tool as a starting point in the hands of certain trained medical professionals. It is also used as data when making medical decisions in acute or long-term healthcare settings. In my opinion, it's become very overused in other settings by people who shouldn't be trying to interpret weight and metabolic issues. Last word from our listener, Melissa.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.